SB 100 is sending a message to California and to the world that we're going to meet the Paris Agreement and we're going to continue down that path to transition our economy to zero emission, zero carbon emission, and to have the resiliency and the sustainability that science tells us we must achieve. This bill and the executive order that I'm going to sign will put California on a path to the goals to meet the Paris Agreement and beyond. It's not going to be easy, and it will not be immediate, but it must be done.
Governor Jerry Brown today signing a bill committing California to a carbon-free electricity grid by 2045. It is an ambitious goal and one that goes perfectly with the governor's Global Climate Summit that's kicking off Wednesday. Lots of headlines for Jerry Brown this week. We're going to talk with him on this show tomorrow, but not everyone thinks Jerry Brown is doing enough on the environmental front. Tens of thousands of people turned out over the weekend at protests in San Francisco to call for more action. Some 800 groups have signed onto a campaign called Brown's Last Chance, which calls for a commitment to zero fossil fuels. We're going to talk about that now with Bill McKibben. He's co-founder of 350.org. That's a global environmental group. Hi there.
Hello there. How are you?
Great. And how are you?
Pretty good. It's a gorgeous day in San Francisco, I got to say.
Okay, so you're there obviously for the summit and for these for the weekend's protests. What do you make of the governor signing this bill? Are you pleased?
Well, I'm glad he signed it. I think most of the credit really has to go to Kevin DeLeon, who shepherded it through the State House, and to the enormous number of groups around the state, especially the groups like California Environmental Justice Alliance that really spearheaded the push on this and other fronts. But as people have been saying, Jerry Brown has really been pretty good over the years on the demand side of the fossil fuel equation. California's done a lot to try and cut energy use and to bring renewables online, and that's a good thing. It's taken full advantage of the Mojave Desert, and that's smart.
Right. But you're going to say, I feel like there's a but to that, and that's the supply side.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that you're correct there. He hasn't done anything except keep signing new permits for more oil wells. He's signed off on way more of those than say, Donald Trump has. And that's a shame, because California should be leading there, too. The problem with the climate crisis is that it forces us all to move more quickly than we want to. There's no question we're losing this fight now. I've just come back from Greenland up on the ice shelf, watching the ice shelf disappear before one's eyes. Anybody who turns on the TV today is going to see the almost unbelievable images of what Hurricane Florence looks like as it descends on the East Coast. We've got to move with way more speed than we're moving. So we're grateful that Jerry Brown has done what he's done today. He's in the perfect position, since he no longer has to run for anything, since he no longer has to worry about the money coming in from the fossil fuel industry for campaigns. He'd be the guy to go ahead and take the leadership on the supply of energy, too.
Right. Well, he says, look, we've got all of these cars on the road that unfortunately use gas. Most of them use gas. And we can't just turn it off. We can't just say, OK, we're now carbon free and we're going to stop pumping oil, because we need it not only for our cars, but also to heat and cool our homes for the time being.
That's exactly right. And no one wants him to turn off every gas station in California tomorrow. That's unrealistic. But that's precisely the reason why he should stop approving new infrastructure, new oil wells, new pipelines, all the other stuff that goes with it, so that we can have the managed decline of the fossil fuel economy that we very badly need. If we don't, then we're just going to get to the point when things get completely out of control that we somehow have to try and turn it off overnight. We won't, no possible way to do it. So California is actually in the perfect position to kind of do this with the grace that both California's supply of renewable energy and its supply of innovative tech skills provides like nowhere else in the world.
So we're going to be talking to the governor tomorrow, so I will definitely ask him this. But what is your guess in terms of his motivation? Because as you say, he deserves a lot of credit for trying to reduce the demand side of it. And he is a global leader when it comes to trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And yet, as you say, he has signed more oil and gas leases than President Trump has. So why do you think there is this contradiction?
It's hard to look inside another person's head or heart. I don't know. And I haven't given up on him yet. One hopes that he'll use the last months in office to do the right thing. If he doesn't, there's no question that this Environmental Justice Alliance is going to keep pushing and pushing hard. 800 groups in the state, as you said, that have come together to say, enough. It's especially remarkable that he keeps approving permits for wells that are right next to people's houses and schools. That's not normal most places in the world, and it's not fair here, where most of them are going in next to communities of color and around poor people. It's really ridiculous at this point for the state that has the technical savvy to be able to move us quickly in another direction.
And how do you feel about the climate summit that's coming up later this week? Do you feel like everyone who needs to be there is there sitting at the table?
Well, I got to say, I think the best part of it already happened.
The protests?
This, march on Saturday in San Francisco was one of 900 in 90 countries around the world, and I got to watch the pictures as they flowed in from all around the planet. It was pretty grand. It was pretty grand in San Francisco. Among other things, the biggest street murals ever in history. Very beautiful. People should track down the pictures. I hope some of that spirit carries over into the conference hall. The truth about climate conferences over the years is they're more a theater for rhetoric than they are a source of action. But perhaps that's changing. A really good piece of news came earlier today when the mayors of London and New York City, the two biggest financial centers in the universe, issued a challenge to all the other mayors of the world to divest their pension funds from fossil fuels. If we start really undercutting the money that is the oxygen on which global warming burns, then maybe we'll be getting somewhere.
Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline. Have a good day.
Well, Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's hearings may have wrapped up, but the controversy surrounding them, well, it is still lingering this week. Namely, there's a question over whether Kavanaugh perjured himself. Documents released by the Senate committee overseeing the hearings and some Democrats who went rogue show inaccuracies in Kavanaugh's testimony. The first case centers on his involvement in the confirmation process of a lower court judge during the George W. Bush years. Another deals with private files from Democrats that were improperly obtained and circulated by the Republicans also in the early 2000s. The committee will likely vote on Kavanaugh in the next few weeks. It is Monday, and that means our legal Jessica Levinson is here, law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hello.
First, let's cut to the chase. Did he or did he not perjure himself?
Well, wouldn't it be so exciting if I said,
yes,
federal perjury? But
exactly.
I think by now your listeners know that I try and really ramp down on the excitement here. So I think that, look, I think that there are some places where we can look and see inaccuracies, but to rise to the level of a federal perjury charge is actually quite difficult.
Which and is so, what? Knowingly and willfully lying under oath?
Yes. So it is knowingly or willfully. You don't have to prove both because they basically mean the same thing. And knowing or willful means it wasn't a mistake or I didn't have amnesia or I didn't just accidentally say that. And then it has to be a false statement. It has to be a false statement of material fact, meaning it made a difference. And in this case, it made a difference, I think, really means they would not have confirmed you, Brett Kavanaugh, to the lower court when you were in your 2006 hearings, if we had known that, and then fill in the blank inaccuracies, mm-hmm. and you have to be under oath.
Okay, so what are they arguing over? What is it that is raising some suspicions?
So there's a couple of issues, as you talked about. There's the confirmation of Judge William Pryor, who was nominated by George W. Bush, and in 2006, Kavanaugh told late Senator Ted Kennedy, "I wasn't involved in selecting and vetting Judge Pryor." He kind of walked that statement back a little bit last week, and he essentially said, I may have been involved in an interview, but I don't remember that. And then Senator Patrick Leahy said, I have an email that shows somebody emailed you and said, how was the interview with Judge Pryor? And you wrote back, call me. Now, I think that if you look at the full context, I think for sure last week, he left himself enough room where he said, maybe. The problem for him is his statement in 2006 does sound pretty unequivocal. But I think that because he said selection and vetting, there's still room for him to say, well, I was kind of informally involved. And that's, again, when we're talking about federal perjury charges, is there some other way that maybe we don't totally believe it, but there's another way to explain it?
And the other one was whether or not he knew that some Oppo research documents were improperly obtained.
Exactly. So there was a Republican staffer, and he obtained kind of improperly opposition research by Democrats on judicial nominees. And this lower Republican staffer shared that information with Judge Kavanaugh when he was then working for the White House. And Judge Kavanaugh in 2006 said, I didn't know that those documents were stolen. I didn't receive anything mm-hmm. that was stolen. And then last week, he said essentially the same thing. I wasn't aware that there was anything improper. And people are looking at the emails and saying, well, the email says confidential. The email says not for distribution. And so this must have raised some red flags for you. And he's saying, no, it didn't. We could have bipartisan efforts. We could have had a Democrat who's a mole. I mean, so he's saying mm-hmm. it didn't rise yeah. to the level for me.
And I guess strains credulity for some people who say, look, you're a smart guy. Like, come on.
Exactly.
You know how Washington works.
So I would say kind of the moral of the story for perjury is it might strain credulity, but that doesn't mean that we can prove a federal perjury
charge. So do you come away with this thinking the Democrats are really grasping at straws here at almost anything to try to prevent this inevitable, what looks like an inevitable confirmation? Or are there some real red flags here?
So I think that there are some real issues with his testimony. I don't think that it rises to the level of perjury. But I think that what we need to do is look at the fact that, one, we have a small sliver of the documents that are out there on Judge Kavanaugh. I think for Justice Elena Kagan, we had more than 90% of the documents related to her time, for instance, working in the White House. For Judge Kavanaugh, we have a relatively small percentage. So I think we need to look at that. I think we need to look at what his answers were on substantive issues and how he's ruled as a lower court judge. And so people are kind of picking apart his testimony and saying, what did he know? What did he say? But I think we really need to look at how is he ruled on privacy rights as a lower court judge? How is he ruled on criminal justice issues? How is he ruled on affirmative action? How is he ruled on racial discrimination? So there's a lot of really important issues, and we're not really spending time on those.
And do you think that his testimony changed the minds of anyone?
No, I think that he did exactly what you're supposed to do, which is he conveyed virtually nothing about himself, about his views. And he did what Supreme Court justices are supposed to do, which is to say, I'm just a really smart person who has basically no set or conclusions about anything dealing with the law. And I'm a blank slate. And now everybody's favorite metaphor, I'm just an umpire, as Chief Justice Roberts used it so well. So did he convey anything? No, I can't imagine that changed anybody's mind.
Okay, let's move on to another story. Trump administration proposing a new plan to detain kids who cross the border with their family. And the plan would allow for families to be held together indefinitely.
Yes. So
that's not legal. right?
That's not the current law. That's right. So right now we're operating under something called the Flores Consent Decree, which is basically a settlement agreement that occurred in federal court. And a judge has interpreted and decided that that agreement means you can't hold children alone or with their families for more than 20 days because it causes physical problems. It causes emotional problems. I think it's kind of obvious the psychological problems that it could cause a child. And so the Trump administration, like other administrations, tried to challenge that consent decree in court. The judge said, no, I'm not seeing these challenges as being successful. And so what the Trump administration is now trying to do is move from court to the administrative realm. And they're telling the Department of Homeland Security, you need to create new regulations that supersede and replace the Flores consent decree and allow children to be held until their entire asylum case or immigration case is finished, which could be months or in some case even years. And what...
So they're basically trying to come up with a rule that would supersede the ruling.
Exactly.
Is that, can you do that?
So the Flores Agreement was always supposed to be temporary and it was supposed to be codified, but it has to be codified in a way that is consistent with the agreement. And I think what the Trump administration is arguing is, look, we're just providing some details. And I think what other people are arguing is, no, you're going directly against what this consent decree says, which is you cannot hold children indefinitely because there are very real harms that result from doing that.
So who will decide whether or not they can do that?
So it will be, I believe, Federal Judge Dolly G, who's overseeing the Flores consent decree. Thus far, she has not looked favorably at the Trump administration challenges. And so part of this is I think the Trump administration really wants to have this consent decree lifted. And part of it is I think going into the midterms, they want to say, we're doing everything we can and we keep being thwarted by this liberal Ninth Circuit judge who's not letting us execute our duties.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you.
Okay, one more newsy item today from Washington, where the Trump administration is moving to close the offices of the Palestine Liberation Organization. A State Department spokesperson said it is tied to the stalled peace process. A senior Palestinian official called it a needless escalation. Missy Ryan covers the Pentagon and military issues for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, so John Bolton talked about this in a speech in front of the Federalist Society earlier today. What was the reasoning for the decision?
Well, it's interesting that the PLO announcement was sort of a side note in a speech that was more centrally focused on the International Criminal Court. But what Bolton said, what the announcement was regarding the PLO mission is twofold. Number one, the administration deems that the Palestinian authorities haven't taken sufficient steps to support a hoped-for peace deal between Palestinian officials and Israel, and also the Trump administration is acutely critical of a move that the Palestinian Authority has taken at the ICC, trying to basically request a case or bring a case against Israel for alleged war crimes against the Palestinian people. And the United States believes that that's illegitimate. Number one, it's not supportive of the ICC, and number two, it believes that the Palestinian Authority is wrongly trying to show itself to be a state in that forum.
Mm, okay. So, but this follows the Trump administration taking actions that the Palestinians have viewed as contrary, to put it mildly, for example, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Sure. There's been a sort of steady chipping away on the part of the Trump administration of the at least its perceived authority and legitimacy of the PA since Trump took office. You know, they've done everything from announced that they would move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and they've cast doubts on the right of refugee return. And more generally, I think there obviously is a perception among the Palestinians that any peace proposal, once it's actually released, there's been a proposal that the administration has been working on for some time, but they haven't made it public, would be, in their eyes, biased towards Israel.
Mm. All right. So what has been the reaction from Mahmoud Abbas and the rest of the Palestinian delegation?
Well, the Palestinian authorities are outraged, and their chief negotiator said that the United States will be proved to be on the wrong side of history. And I think that this is just an affirmation of their perception of bias towards Israel. And, you know, it represents a further alienation between the Palestinian officials and the Trump administration. It really makes it harder to think that there would be some sort of meaningful peace process that would begin during this administration.
All right. So if the reason for doing this is, they're purporting that the authority has not helped in the peace process in any way, how can this help that along?
I don't think it will. I mean, I think that the Trump administration would say that the peace process needs to happen on its terms, on what it would say are the correct terms. And the Palestinian Authority would say that this is, you know, these are terms that are tantamount to sort of taking their demands off the table from the beginning of any potential negotiation. So I think it's also important to put this in the context of what Bolton was trying to do in his first speech as National Security Advisor for President Trump, which is really deliver a broadside against global cooperation at the International Criminal Court. And this is, you know, these two issues have become intertwined at the margins because of the potential case against Israel. But it is symbolic of what this administration's philosophy is when it comes to multilateral forums like the ICC.
So best to pull out and do it.
Well, they're not a member state now, but they will do. They are threatening to take to impose sanctions and travel bans on prosecutors and judges and anyone affiliated with potential cases against Americans. And obviously, they oppose cases against American allies, and that in this case, it would be Israel. And so that is one facet of their opposition to the PLO case.
Mizzi Ryan covers the Pentagon and military issues for The Washington Post. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. CBS chief Les Moonves is out.
It is the first example of a Fortune 500 CEO, someone who is really thought to be immune to criticism because he is so indispensable to billions of dollars of transactions, has stepped down. You know, this is a first.
That's Ronan Farrow of The New Yorker magazine on Good Morning America this morning. He is primarily the reason Moonves is out. He wrote two articles in The New Yorker where 12 women accuse Moonves of sexual assault and harassment. The latest came out yesterday. Hours later, CBS announced Moonves had left the company and would not receive any of his exit compensation for now. Joining us now is Kim Masters. She is editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCW's The Business. Hi there.
Hello.
Well, until yesterday, it looked like Moonves was going to hang on until the bitter end. So was it this second article, that basically forced CBS to say, you're out?
Yeah, this second article is a lot more graphic. The behavior described is much more graphic and violent than anything described in the first piece. The first piece had behavior that was not what I would by any means acceptable, mm-hmm. but he was not forcing himself on women. And in this case, there are graphic depictions of him doing exactly that. This all happened quite a long time ago, but obviously at a certain point doesn't matter when it happened because this behavior is completely unacceptable. And at that point, Sherry Redstone, who has been trying to in this battle with him over who is going to control CBS and whether they merge CBS with her other company, Viacom, you know, all of that, it was a battle going on legally. There was a trial coming up. There were already settlement discussions for Les Moonves to make an exit, but this definitely expedited things.
Well, let's talk about that because there have been whispers from his camp that she orchestrated some of this, that she may have fed Ronan Farrow some of this information.
Well, look, I don't think Ronan Farrow is taking direct assistance from Sherry Redstone. The first article, I think there was a little bit of a question over whether, you know, unbeknownst to Ronan, maybe he had, a source had approached him with an allegation that many in the Hollywood were not entirely sure whether they should believe or not, which seemed to be an important part of his first story. You know, there's no proof one way or the other. I do feel very confident saying that Ronan would not participate in a smear campaign that Sherry was orchestrating. I think Ronan genuinely believed there was a story there, and obviously the history has proved him correct. So it does at the same time totally serve Shari Redstone's agenda, because she has been wanting to merge her two halves of the empire that her father built, CBS and Viacom, which is the home of MTV and BET and Nickelodeon and Comedy Central and Paramount Pictures, all of those things. She wanted to merge them together. This business is undergoing drastic transformation. The belief is size is very important. Even the combined companies may not be big enough. Now, it's not clear that they said they will not necessarily do anything for 2 years, but it's unclear, might they sell one and not the other, or part of one, or might they just decide, actually, they don't have to wait 2 years. All of that is up in the air right now.
Okay. So, and meanwhile, Moonves still denying these allegations, saying that, first of all, they happened decades ago and they're not consistent with who he is. Many of these encounters were consensual, he says. And he basically says, like we were just discussing, alluding to a concerted effort to remove him. Meanwhile, though, he and CBS, or CBS says they will donate in his name some of his supposed restitution, $20 million or so to a Me Too organization.
Yeah, there was already an investigation into Les Moonves' conduct, as well as what went on at CBS News, where there have been allegations that it was a boys' club with inappropriate behavior. So that was already going on, and that is not going to stop. They folded the two investigations together. They're going to continue them. And then there will be a decision as to what, if any, compensation Moonves is entitled to. He could have had, you know, over $100 million. The agreement now is whatever happens, $20 million, either of his money or CBS's money, will go to Time's Up causes. And Time's Up has a legal defense fund for women outside Hollywood dealing with sexual harassment issues. Mm-hmm. So that's a big boost for them. But, you know, it's going to take a while, I think, to figure out just how completely and utterly they will say you are not entitled to money.
Right. Well, how does CBS come off in this whole thing? Because, as you say, after the first article, nothing really was done with Moonves. He remained in place. Now it seems they acted very swiftly, and they're making this $20 million contribution, and they've replaced some of the board members. How do you assess CBS's actions in all this?
There is a question of what the previous board, the more Moonves-friendly board, knew and when they knew it. And Shari Redstone and another board member had asked. She is a member of both the CBS board and the Viacom board. So as a member of the CBS board, she and another sympathetic to her side board member had said back in June, I think, or earlier, well before Ronan's story ran, we need an investigation into Les Moonves. But that was seen as part of her effort to unseat him because he didn't want to merge CBS and Viacom. And there had been rumors for a long time, and it took quite a while for this to gel into a story. And, you know, bear in mind that Les Moonves is considered one of the great TV programmers of all time. He is a very valuable asset, very prized on Wall Street for those skills. And so letting go of him was not something that CBS would be eager to do, and maybe that CBS shareholders wouldn't be eager to do. And that may, you know, explain why the board was so sluggish and didn't respond, because it was better just to say, don't make waves. But if that became intolerable.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, there are also allegations against Jeff Fager, not to the level at all of the allegations against Les Moonves. But in that article, in the latest article, women accuse him of groping them and of presiding over a frat boy atmosphere at 60 Minutes. He's the executive producer there. What's going to happen with him and with the larger news culture at CBS?
I'm going to think there's going to have to be a change. I mean, at one point he was on vacation and it appeared he might not come back at all. And then he did come back. And many people, I think, were slightly surprised by that. He almost got a stay of execution, I think, because they decided to fold the investigation into 60 Minutes in the news division, which, of course, also involved Charlie Rose, in with this new, at the time, Les Moonves investigation. But I wouldn't expect for him to be there. And I would think that women will have to be put into top jobs at CBS and CBS News. It just as happened at Amazon when the head of Amazon Studios was ushered out with allegations of misconduct. That place is now run by Jen Psaki, and it's a new day. So I think that kind of thing is going to happen at CBS as well.
Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you.
Coming up, two Orange County high schools, one white, one Latino, meet on the football field. And then some racism happens. That's coming up. Plus, some new apartments are more like dorms than homes. Who's living there?
We have a starter who's just kind of coming to a new city and like wants to grab the life by its horns, you know, and just like have a great time. We have a restarter, you know, somebody who's 30 to 45, maybe had a divorce or got out of a relationship or had a really tough roommate situation.
Dorm living for grownups. That's coming up on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In Orange County on Friday, two high school football teams faced off. The Saints of Santa Ana High visited the Wolverines of Aliso Niguel. Aliso Niguel is a mainly white school, Santa Ana High, 99% Latino. According to people at the game, the Santa Ana players were met with a lot of Wolverine supporters dressed in patriotic red, white, and blue. There were chants of USA after Wolverine touchdowns, and there were a few signs saying things like, "We love white, and we're going to trump you." Howard Bloom is education reporter for the LA Times. Hi there.
Hey.
Okay. First of all, what are you hearing happened at that game with these signs and the chants? What was going on with that?
Well, I should say I wasn't at the game. I spoke to many people who were, and just like eyewitness accounts, the stories vary. There seems to be no dispute that the chants of USA happened after touchdowns by the Aliso Niguel team. And I think it's also important to say that after the principal at Santa Ana complained, that the Aliso Niguel principal tried to put a stop to those chants and anything else that the Santa Ana team might be intimidated by. But those USA chants did take place. And, of course, both schools are part of the USA. And there was a sign that said something, you know, "We're going to trump you." I've seen pictures of that. There's a dispute over whether there was a sign or any chants about build the wall. Some people say they heard those chants that refer to Donald Trump's campaign pledge to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. There are other people who say that absolutely did not happen. So, and as far as the "We Like White," that was the schools, what the people at Aliso Niguel say is that, well, it was a red, white, and blue night. We also had signs saying, "We like blue," and "We like red," and "We like white." So I guess what the other side would say is that all these things taken together, whether they were meant to do it or not, created an atmosphere of intimidation.
Right. And so the principal of Santa Ana High School, as you said, went up to the principal of the other high school and said, you know, "Make this stop or we're leaving. We're going to stop playing the game."
That's right. He threatened to pull his team from the field, and the coach actually concurred. It was the coach who suggested that that might be a good idea, and then the principal concurred. Apparently there was a school board member there, and they conferred with the school board member as well. And the principal for Aliso Niguel apparently immediately went into action, and the two principals hugged at some point because they were somewhat on the same page, at least in having good intentions. They felt at the game. Where this kind of blew up on social media, of course, is when the principal from Santa Ana posted about this, because he just felt
in talking to him over the weekend that he needed to take a stand and point out something that he felt uncomfortable about. And he has a lot of people calling him a hero. A lot of people are saying, hey, this was unnecessary grandstanding. You worked this out of the game. Why bring it up any further? And that's kind of where we are. It's sort of now reached national attention at this point.
Right. And what is also interesting is he's white.
Yes. Well, the other interesting thing is that the principal from Santa Ana, which is the all-Latino school, he actually lives in the city where the other high school is located, and he lives about a mile away from the other high school. So he's a resident of that city.
Interesting. Well, looking at the page of the school's administrators, it looks like most, if not all, are white. And yet, as you know, the school is 99% Latino. So is that a problem, or is that something that is you see as a situation in a lot of public schools?
Well, I think you see that. I mean, there's a lot of debate in education over the extent to which your teachers and administrators should look like the students they're teaching. And obviously, it can be a very good thing when you want, you know, if you're looking for students to have mentors, you want things that they have in common. Now, does the thing that they have in common have to be ethnicity? It could be a love for English literature or math or the arts. It's probably not as important as having a great teacher, but it can matter. It certainly is a positive to have role models that remind students of themselves.
Right. And in this situation, he seems to be a pretty good role model, Jeff Bishop.
Well, he has many people on his side singing his praises. At the other high school, they feel that he has blown this way out of proportion. That's what I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess where you stand depends on where you live, where you sit.
Yeah. But he did defuse the situation, right, by reaching out to the other principal and trying to calm down the situation during the game?
Right, and where the other school, where some of their fans object, is they say, well, why did you post this after the game?
Right.
We dealt with it at the game. Why did you have to make this a bigger issue? And his answer to that is, well, it's a matter of principle. I don't want this to happen again, and I feel that people need to be called out on this. And if they're not aware when they're being racially insensitive, then this is he would regard it as him taking advantage of a teachable moment. His critics accuse him of grandstanding.
Who won the game?
Well, it was actually Aliso Nagel that won the game 42-21. And people on both sides say that the players were sportsmen on both sides, so that none of this was coming from the players on the field before, during, or after the game.
Okay, so maybe they're the role models. Howard Bloom, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You know it's a struggle to keep up with LA's high rents. So how about moving into a community home to save money? That's a building where you share a kitchen, a bathroom, and a living room with other tenants. There's a new one opening in Venice this month. More on the way. Well, are they a great way to save money in the most sought-after neighborhoods, or are they just glorified and expensive dorms for grown-ups? Press Play's Anna Scott spoke to the head of a San Francisco startup specializing in these projects, and he just announced big plans for LA. Hi.
Hi.
All right, so who is this guy?
His name is John Deshotsky. He's the CEO of a startup called Star City that specializes in these co-living projects. And like you said, they just announced that they have one opening in Venice this month. There are going to be people moving in at the beginning of October. It's on Navy Street, so a couple of blocks from the ocean near Rose Avenue, if you're mm-hmm. familiar with Venice. And they have apparently two other projects in the works as well for LA on the west side, although they have not announced any details of those yet. But more to come. So they're making a big play into the LA market, and they are not the only company doing this. There are other projects like this from other companies in development as well. So, you know, the saying that we have in journalism, 1-2 trend.
All right. Well, describe how it works.
So let's look at this Venice building as an example. This company, Star City, what they do is they take buildings that already exist, maybe were offices or used for some other purpose. In this case, this was previously corporate housing for Snapchat, actually. and they convert them into this combination of micro studios. So there are some about 31 apartments in this building, and about half are studios, very small studios that do have their own bathrooms, a little more privacy. But then the other half are these co-living units where you basically have a bedroom, but you share a kitchen, you share a living space, you share bathrooms. The whole communal aspect of it is part of their marketing. They have book clubs, then they have organized outings, and they have wine nights and things like that. So part of what they're selling is this experience. And here's John talking about that.
What can we build that will allow you, one, access to the best locations and jobs, two, you know, sort of your foot in the door for culture, nightlife, arts, entertainment, and then three, a sense of neighborhood and community that seems to be somewhat lacking in their sort of socially isolated world.
Now, if you look at where this company is going, it's San Francisco, Los Angeles, not just Los Angeles, but some of the most expensive
right.
neighborhoods in Los Angeles, Venice and the West Side. So, okay, yes, you get this kind of communal living, but also this is a way to rent an apartment that might be a little more affordable than the typical market rate apartment.
And how much is it?
Well, here's another twist. It's actually not that cheap. At this project in Venice, the rents start at $2,200 a month, and they go up to $3,100. So that's not a small amount of money.
For a one bedroom with nothing else but the bedroom and the communal living.
Right, for the lower end of that price point. For the higher end, you will get a very tiny studio. You get housekeeping, things like that. It also includes utilities, I should mention that. I asked John about this, and here's what he says.
The fact of the matter is, like, the average studio in these neighborhoods is often north of, you know, $3,500. So it's significantly cheaper than the existing alternatives. That being said, I agree with you that it's not the holy grail yet. We are working on that.
He's saying, well, it's cheap for Venice Beach, right? So I did the math, and actually to afford the lowest end of what they're going to be charging at this Navy Street project, if you follow the formula of spending about a third of your income on rent and utilities, you'd have to be taking home about $79,000 a year. So it's not low-income housing. They do say that they're working on that for future projects, that they want to offer an even lower price point and maybe do some actual low-income housing, but they are not there yet. Here's John describing the tenants that they have. He breaks them up into a few different categories.
We kind of have four different customer types. We have the starter who's just kind of coming to a new city and like wants to grab the life by its horns, you know, and just like have a great time. We have a restarter, you know, somebody who's 30 to 45 who maybe had a divorce or got out of a relationship or had a really tough roommate situation. We have life shapers, we call them, who are like co-living is the future. They're sort of power users for us. And then we have samplers who are, you know, in-town nurses or interns that are sort of coming in from out of town that just sort of need a better place than a hotel to live.
Nurses, interns, they're not going to be able to afford that.
I don't know. Maybe some will.
I'm interested in who he calls the life shapers.
Right.
Who are they? They see co-living as the future.
Co-living as the future. Right. So these are like the people that just really believe in the idea of this and are really into the co-living aspect of it, regardless of the price. I mean, it's hard to know, of course, how big any of these little brackets are. I am naturally skeptical that there's a huge number of people that are just dying to share kitchens and bathrooms with others and pay a pretty high premium to do it. But admittedly, that is my own bias. I am not their target audience for this. I, you know, live with a baby and a spouse, and I'm not a joiner, really. So this isn't for me. I did talk to an official with another company called Ollie that's based in New York that does these same kind of projects. And they also have something in development in Los Angeles, actually downtown. They're turning the old Cecil Hotel, one of my favorite things to talk about, into one of these projects. I asked them the same question. They say that there is a contingent of people that are really enthusiastic about living in these kinds of buildings. And the example that they pointed to is a project that they have in Pittsburgh, which is a much cheaper market than LA or San Francisco. And they say it's been very popular there. So that's the evidence they point to in terms of the demand for living in this kind of project, just for the lifestyle piece of it.
So it's built-in socializing. So you get an instant group of friends or people to do stuff with. It sort of takes the isolation, the loneliness of big city living out if you're, let's say, a newcomer to the city.
Right. And if you go to the website for any of these things, I mean, if you go to the Star City website, you see people standing around the communal kitchen, having a glass of wine, looking very young and hip and cool. So it is part of their marketing strategy. There's, I should mention also another, at least one other company entering the LA market in this realm called Treehouse. They are working on a similar project in Hollywood.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, it does call to mind SROs, single room occupancy hotels,
right,
and also places where seniors go to live once their kids and grandkids are out of the house and they can't take care of a big house on their own. They move into these kinds of places.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I mentioned to John the SRO comparison, the single room occupancy housing, which is sort of hybrid hotel apartment complexes that serve really low income people. And they kind of have a stigma around them to some degree. I mean, here in LA, we associate them with Skid Row. But John said he doesn't mind the comparison. He says, you know, those buildings played a super important role in offering affordable housing post-World War II. And he likes to think that although what they are doing is much more upscale and catering to a different demographic, he likes to think that they're filling this niche in the housing market. And I mean, how widespread this becomes, we will see.
Okay. Anna Scott, reporter and producer for Press Play, thank you very much.
You're welcome.